This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur einen Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella. And from the BBC, this is Extreme. Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
In the small Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan, young Buddhist nuns are preparing to meditate. Around 1,000 girls and women like these live in nunneries, often in remote areas. But for the first time in centuries, these nuns now have the chance to reach the same level of ordination as Buddhist monks, to be fully ordained as bhikshunis or gelongma.
This is the ultimate goal that every nun must have. But the nuns never had this dream because it was understood that they are not able to and it's not possible.
For decades, a debate has raged over whether women in the Vajrayana branch of Buddhism could be fully ordained. But 3 years ago, Bhutan took the lead and, in an historic ceremony, ordained 144 women.
This is the patched cloth that goes with the full ordination. There was this change from the nuns wearing burgundy to wearing this beautiful golden colour, and that was quite stunning to see because prior to that time, obviously, we'd only ever seen monks in Bhutan wearing this colour.
And British Buddhist Emma Slade was among them. I'm Julia Paul, and this is the documentary from the BBC World Service. For this episode of Heart and Soul, which explores stories of spirituality, I'm talking to Emma about being a Buddhist in the UK and Bhutan, her part in the historic ceremony, and what it's been like to break the glass ceiling in Buddhism. I'm on a train to a small town in the south of England, around an hour from London.
We will shortly be arriving at Whitstable.
This is where Emma Slade was born and still lives when she's not in Bhutan.
Perfect timing.
Quite as glamorous as Bhutan, is it?
Hello,
hi,
it's so lovely
just,
to meet
you. I was waving
at
my waving up, my husband's getting a bit confused.
Whitstable is on the coast, very different to landlocked Bhutan.
Sometimes, if it's really clear, you can see Southend up there.
I mean, it's a lovely day, but it's a bit hazy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of beautiful, though, isn't it?
When I stand by the water, it feels very helpful in terms of meditation. You know, you can hear it coming in and going out, coming in and going out.
Emma, who's also known as Lopen Annie Pima Deki, really stands out here with her colourful robes, sandals and shaved head.
I love Whitstable. I know loads of people here and it's a simple place for me to be, but, you know, there's no temples or golden roofs or lamas to talk to. It's one of the reasons why I've had to be very self-determined and self-disciplined, because you can see here there's nobody I can go and do some prayers with or chat to about Tibetan or whatever. You could easily give up here. Nobody's going to know. Nobody's going to notice. No one's going to care. So when I'm in Bhutan, it's so supportive of me because I can talk about texts and discuss the meaning of something and learn some musical instrument for prayers or something. So it's that support system, Buddhist support system, that I don't really really happy.
So how did someone born in this very English seaside town become a Buddhist?
I do feel as if I've always been Buddhist. We had this lying Buddha from Burma in the house that I grew up in from my grandfather. And from a very early age, I just felt very drawn to it. You know, I like to try to do my version of meditating. But obviously at that time, I had nobody to take it any further. There was no temples, there was no monks. And so I guess that interest remained latent, really.
But then in 1997, an intensely traumatic event reignited that interest.
I was working in Hong Kong as a senior financial analyst. I went on a business trip to Jakarta in Indonesia and had the bad luck to be held hostage at gunpoint in my hotel. That was obviously a very big experience in my life and led to lots of feelings and thoughts. But one of the primary feelings was one of great sorrow. I mean, obviously that I was probably about to die. That was pretty sad, but that I was about to die and I had left no positive impact on the world. I'd really done nothing to help anybody. I realized after I did survive the incident that that idea of somehow finding a deeper life that really made a contribution was going to be very important to me. It drives me up until this day. I think that wish has not left me, yeah.
And so how did you then move from that sense of wanting to do something to becoming a full Buddhist?
I had a lot of recovery to go through. And I found in the end that yoga with the breathing, the meditation, the postures, it was the most wonderful thing. A way to keep yourself well and healthy and happy that I just hadn't known about before. And I think that eventually led to the earlier interest in Buddhism really coming alive. And then eventually I went to Sami Ling, which is a Buddhist monastery in Scotland. And I heard these compassion prayers there with this mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And I guess that was a bit of a moment there. And eventually I formally became a Buddhist at that monastery. And then the interest in yoga and Buddhism eventually, you know, led to me visiting Bhutan for the first time in 2011.
Even at our home here in Whitstable, it feels as if Bhutan is all around us.
What we're looking at.
Yeah, so this is my practice area with my shrine. So these are tankas, painted Buddhist pictures, which are always framed. Bhutan is a Vajrayana Buddhist country. The Buddhism there has been in place for many centuries, uninterrupted. There are three main buckets of Buddhism. There's Theravadan, which tends to be in Southeast Asia. There's Mahayana, which is in China, Japan, Korea. And then there's Vajrayana, which is in the Himalayan region, including Bhutan. So from my first visit to Bhutan, when I met this Lama, some relationship has just grown and grown. At first, it was very much about finding Lama as a teacher, because I hadn't found a teacher in the West that I felt some kind of connection to, and I really felt it with Lama Nyima Sering. So I think later on, my understanding of how the circumstances of Bhutan itself, the environment, the pilgrimage places, the attitude that comes with learning inside a Buddhist culture, not learning in a Western culture. I think in the end that obviously started to become very important for me as well.
So these are photographs?
Yeah, these are photographs. And
oh my gosh, I'm meeting the Princess of Wales?
That's right, and then the chap who came with him.
The Prince of Wales.
But yeah, I should say, yeah. So that was in Bhutan.
Emma's relationship with Bhutan has also been about giving back. She founded a charity to support children with disabilities. It's called Open Your Heart to Bhutan.
I began to go to rural areas where I realised actually there was quite a need for more help for special needs children and children in far-flung rural areas. And I felt I really wanted to do something about that. And so that's why I founded the charity, which is in its 10th year now. So my relationship with Bhutan is quite full and complicated really now. It's not just a question of going there for lovely teachings and feeling very happy. It's also got a very strong practical part to it.
Despite all of this study and charity work, Emma had never considered being fully ordained to the same level as a Buddhist monk, to become what's called a Gelongma, or Bhikshuni.
In global Buddhism, there are terms for male and female, whether they're lay practitioner or a monastic practitioner. So you have Gelong for a male fully ordained monastic, and Gelongma, with this ma being the female element, and then Bhikkhu and Bhikshuni. So again, Bhikkhu is the male, Bhikshuni is the female.
But this level of ordination just wasn't possible in her branch of Buddhism.
There is this belief that women have to ordain women. Mm. And at some point, the female fully ordained monastics died out.
Yeah, because it's not been possible in the Himalayas, a lot of females to gain full ordination have had to go to a different lineage in Taiwan, Hong Kong, but not in the Vajrayana lineage. They've had to go into the Mahayana side of things. And so my link with Bhutan is very strong. I just didn't feel particularly interested in going to do this ordination in another lineage.
But in 2022, in Bhutan, everything changed.
144 women have been inducted as Bhutanese monks in a historic ceremony. It was a big moment for the Himalayan kingdom.
In the time of the Buddha, obviously there was no females to ordain females. The Buddha had to ordain the females. And so if there's a cohort of senior monks, they can give the ordination to females just as occurred in the time of the Buddha. So this was the decision that Bhutan took to do the ordination there in 2022.
Buddhist nuns from all over the world, as well as Bhutan, took part. All in all, 144 were ordained, overseen by the Jay Kenpo, the head of Buddhism in Bhutan.
It was obviously very significant. Everything was done to make the ceremony amazing, from the choice of where it happened in Bhutan at the bottom of Taksang near where Gelongpa Palmo's temple is, to the fact that His Holiness the Jay Kenpo himself was mainly in charge of granting the precepts, the fact that the Queen Mother of Bhutan was there, the Prime Minister of Bhutan was there. I mean, every kindness and respect was paid to the ceremony and the nuns there, and I think that was really, really a big deal.
Is it possible to sum up what it was like for you being a part of that ceremony?
Oh, gosh, lots of different feelings and emotions, right? Fear was a big part, just because I didn't want to mess it up, because I was the only Westerner there. And I was terrified that when you speak the vows back to His Holiness Jay Kenpo, that my Tibetan would be rubbish. But moments of real awe, like, how did I get to be here, taking part in this? And it was so colorful, and everything was very bright, and you know, sky was very blue, and they had the prayer ceremony tents, and then there was flowers and offering bowls. Visually, it was absolutely stunning to be part of it. Yeah, I just kept kind of pinching myself.
And it was a 3-day ceremony.
Yeah, I mean, we were there for more like 5 days, because we had preparation to be told how to do things. It was really, really wonderful. It was incredible. And I felt very proud of Bhutan, and very lucky that my Buddhist path had really taken place all in Bhutan, and therefore be able to be part of this historic event I had never imagined.
You're listening to Heart and Soul on the BBC World Service.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella. And from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme. Peak danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Julia Paul, and I'm talking to British Buddhist Emma Slade about her journey to becoming the first and only Western woman to be fully ordained in Bhutan. At the end of last year, as many around the world were celebrating Christmas, Emma was back in the Himalayas. Part of her time was spent hiking in the Bhutanese mountains with her friend and colleague Rinzin Lendup. She's preparing to walk across Bhutan to raise money for her charity.
We're very high up in the mountains above Paro. We can see Jomolhari, second highest mountain in Bhutan, and on the other side of it is Tibet. We're up here in a very peaceful place, and it's fragrant. We have a lot of pine needles covering all the ground as Rinzin and I are walking here, and just a few traditional farmhouse buildings, but some of them have people doing long-term retreat in them. And just in front of us now are some very tall white flags blowing gently in the breeze. So Rinzin, your father has done 9 years in retreat up here in the mountains of Bhutan. Maybe you can just say why for an Annie it's very important to do retreat.
It's something that you have been practicing. To put that practice into a reality, one has to at least go for a retreat so that you can see how far you have learned doing by yourself.
Emma is planning a month-long retreat herself later this year. And here in the mountains, she found new retreat huts have been built, especially for the newly ordained nuns to use.
How many nuns are here at the moment?
Four
nuns are here at the moment.
And it's perhaps in the Buddhist nuns community where the ordination has had the most significance. I caught up with Emma on a video call when she visited the Bhutan Nuns Foundation.
Bhutan Nuns Foundation was started in 2009. My name is Tashi Zangmo. I'm in Thimphu, Bhutan. I work for the Bhutan Nuns Foundation as an executive director. Bhutan Nuns Foundation was started so that the nuns could learn, besides their monastic education, contemporary trainings like teacher training, health caregiver in the health advice. Her Majesty the Queen Mother is the patron of this foundation, so she thought of starting such an organization so that the nuns throughout the country have this platform.
I was just going to add that when I first knew the foundation, actually, they were quite involved in improving the physical infrastructure of nunneries in the country, which were very, very dilapidated, right? Clean water, bathrooms. There's a lot of other stuff that the Bhutan Nun Foundation has mm-hmm. done and many yes. in many different ways.
Exactly. Because we saw the potential for female monastics to step into the face of the society, and they have a lot to offer. When the world is moving forward, everything is changing. We cannot expect our nuns to live on the mountains in their nunneries, isolated, as though in the 8th century. They have to move together with the world. They need to have the information of the outside world.
Right. You can hear the wind around the Bhutan Nuns Foundation now. So we're just by the river. We've got beautiful sun shining in the river. Dr. Tashi, as ever, is in front of me, moving forward, changing lives, all this kind of thing.
The nunneries mostly are located in the remote corners of Bhutan. Until we came in the picture, neither of the nunneries knew there was another nunnery somewhere else. So they did not even have a connection among themselves. So that's why to learn from each other, to open to the world, because the world needs them as well as they need the outside world.
That's really interesting, because
Many people might think that the monastic tradition is all about inward-looking community inside the nunnery. It's not about connecting with society.
Of course, Buddhism is all taught about looking into yourselves, like you have to think about all the sentient beings besides yourselves. The olden times, they would be focused on gaining enlightenment so that their energy helps the rest of the world. But now, who would believe if you are in the mountains saying your prayers and doing meditation that that helps the rest of the world? So the world needs to be known and shown. Now, younger generation would want to know what you're doing. Otherwise, they will never understand. This is the time I think the society really needs action.
With the training the foundation is offering, Bhutanese nuns can advise local communities on healthcare and rights. But there's also the hope it will raise their profile.
Of course, the services they have always been offering, I can't say they have not benefited the society at all. Bhutan being a very spiritual country, majority are Buddhist. So the monastic's role is really to say prayers for the society. The households invite them and do the rituals. However, those are more so with the monks. The nuns were not educated enough, or they were not known to the society much, and the trust by the society was also a little less.
So we're looking up at all the beautiful mud-packed buildings that Dr. Dashi has incredibly made possible, which is the nature of the Bhutan Nuns Foundation, overlooking the capital of Thimphu here. How do you feel to sit here, Dr. Dashi?
It's wonderful. I always feel so fortunate to have this space for the nuns, created for the nuns.
Why do you feel it's important for Buddhist women to be fully ordained?
I mean, to me, being a woman and also working for the empowerment of the women folks, this is the ultimate goal that every nun must have. And if you say a prayer, the value of the prayers with the ordination has a huge weight and difference. Of course, some of them, our Buddhist nuns, don't even realize what they are missing. But those who are, this is the ultimate goal of their existence. The monks also. But the nuns never had this dream because it was understood that they are not able to and it's not possible.
At the Zilukha Nunnery, just outside the Bhutanese capital, nuns are praying. There are 26 institutions like this across the country. But despite so many nuns now being fully ordained, all of the nunneries are still led by a monk. So what do Bhutan's Buddhist monks think about the female ordination?
Gelonggo ordination is a very important contribution.
Kenpo Kingzang Yeshi is the vice principal of Bhutan's Tango Monastery, one of the most important in the country.
Though Buddha himself ordained nuns during his time, later when the teachings were spread in Tibet, they didn't manage to bring the ordination to Tibet. The followers of Buddha, we used to say that Kor Namba Je, which is the monks and nuns and the lay female and male practitioners, the fourfold sanghas. So for many years, we have been, you know, missing this. All the conditions came together, and it was a very good time to bring back Gelonggo ordination. So His Holiness did this, and I think it's so wonderful.
And Kenpo Yeshe sees the move as bringing equality for Bhutan's nuns.
Without Gelonggo ordination, I think it might have left them with the impression that they're still one step behind the monk, you know. So I think it will be a very inspirational for women nuns, so that they have the opportunity to receive this full ordination and they will have this sense of, you know, equality. Yes.
Totally different
environment.
View to Bhutan.
Yes,
it's the view of the sea.
And
Emma is now back in Whitstable again and at sea level.
and it's a cold, clear day.
And I was actually just thinking, I mean, obviously it's winter now, and, you know, with a shaven head and wearing robes in weather like this. I know it gets cold in Bhutan, but I mean, it's very chilly here at the moment.
Yeah, it's freezing, isn't it? Yeah, the thing about Bhutan is, obviously in the daytime, even the winter, it's sunny. It's blue sky and it's sunny. It's just when the sun goes down, it becomes very cold.
You'll see they have different musical instruments as well.
Back at Emma's house, it's time for a hot cup of tea and some reflection. Would you say that there's a tension, if you like, between the ideal of losing attachment to the self, that is a big part of Buddhism, and the empowerment of women, the pushing forward of women?
I don't know, because we're talking about two different things in a way. So if we look at the causes and conditions for enlightenment, you'll see that one of the very important contributory factors is to have a teacher and access to teachings, etc. Those things need to happen for the person, and knowing that that person is ultimately empty of selfhood is a different thing. That's what we would call on an ultimate level. On a relative level, they still need to eat, they still need to, you know, use a bathroom, and they still need to have access to teachings and retreat huts, right? So that doesn't contradict with Buddhism.
Do you think the ordination in Bhutan will mean that nuns will have the same status in society as the monks?
I think Bhutanese society loves their monks and loves their nuns. In terms of the responsibility, for example, there isn't currently a female in charge of a nunnery in Bhutan. I think we have a little bit of a way to go.
Yeah, so this is the ordination robe that we got. This is the patched cloth that goes with the full ordination. So
the saffron outer robe represents the full ordination.
Yeah, with the patches. Yeah, it's called a namja.
Becoming a Gelongma has made a huge difference to Emma's life as a Buddhist. But it's also clear to me there's still a long way to go for women in Buddhism. Bhutan is planning more ordinations of nuns. And yet, despite the significance of this and the 2022 ceremony, there's been no statement, either criticising or welcoming the move, from the Dalai Lama.
Buddhism is at a very interesting time at the moment. Perhaps some of the emphasis placed on acceptance of whatever is, maybe is being challenged a bit. I mean, certainly in America, Buddhism has been aligned with what's called a social justice movement. Now, that's very different in nature from what I see in Bhutan and other places. How socially active does Buddhism become when it comes into the West, into societies where we're used to expressing our views and pointing out difficulties or problems or inequalities? It's going to be really interesting to see, you know, whether that has an impact back in Asia.
Becoming a Buddhist Bhikshuni in Bhutan was presented by me, Julia Paul, and produced by me and Ruth Purser.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.